It's the NPR News Update for Monday, July 27th. Good day, I'm Phil Picardi with the Minnesota News Podcast. Coming up, where does the rain go after it falls from the sky? What, if anything, should be done about the wolves on Isle Royal? There's only three left. Also, sounds and voices from southeastern Minnesota. First, three people were killed and at least three others wounded in shootings in Minneapolis the last 3 days. Tim Nelson has more.
The latest shooting was early this morning in North Minneapolis. Police say they found one victim dead in the street, and another showed up at North Memorial Medical Center with a non-life-threatening gunshot wound. Another shooting late Saturday night near Franklin and Chicago Avenues left two men dead, and a woman was wounded on Saturday morning in Dinkytown. A driver shot at a group of pedestrians following a verbal dispute. Her injuries are not believed to be life-threatening. Police also shot and wounded a suspect reported to have been seen with a gun in the warehouse district about 3 a.m. on Saturday. That suspect's wounds are not believed to be life-threatening. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
State officials are gathering storm damage data from north-central Minnesota after severe storms earlier this month. It's part of a process to determine if three counties qualify for state assistance. Mike Moen reports.
Today and tomorrow, local officials in Cass, Crow Wing, and Todd counties will meet with members of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, Homeland Security, and Emergency Management Division. The state will assess damage from severe weather that ripped through those counties on July 12th. The Brainerd area was among the communities hardest hit. The storm knocked down trees and forced the closure of popular resorts. State officials will be looking at the extent of damage to public infrastructure, including roads and drainage ditches. They'll also look at the cost to remove debris. If the counties meet a certain threshold, they stand to be reimbursed through a state disaster account. Mike Moen, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A new state task force begins working this week on ways to make Minnesota better prepared to conduct elections in the face of natural disasters and other emergencies. Tim Pugmire reports.
State lawmakers passed a measure earlier this year that established an election emergency planning task force, which is scheduled to meet for the first time Wednesday. The panel will come up with recommendations for how best to handle elections and protect ballots in cases of weather events, national security threats, and other emergency scenarios. DFL Senator Katie Sieben of Newport says state law currently doesn't provide the detail or clarity that's needed.
I think it's imperative that the state give more guidance to local election officials for what to do in an emergency.
The task force, which is made up of state and local officials, will make its report to the legislature in January. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Shoreview-based Ecumen has received a $5 million gift to help people living in the nonprofit's senior citizen residences. Martin Moylan has more on that.
The gift from Debbie and Robert Cervanka of Duluth is the largest ever received by Ecumen. The money will go into a fund that assists residents who exhaust their savings. Judy Blazig is the organization's vice president for philanthropy. She sees the need for senior housing and financial assistance growing.
There are so many Minnesotans turning 65 each year between now and 2038 that will one day either be moving into a community or requiring some kind of care at home. And many of our communities already even have wait lists.
Some 3,300 people live in Ecumen communities in Minnesota. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
When you watch the rain hit the pavement, do you know where it goes? Cities across the state are trying to keep that stormwater near where it falls to prevent it from polluting lakes and rivers. As a result, rain gardens and other so-called green infrastructure are popping up everywhere. Elizabeth Dunbar has more.
We've all stuck out our tongues to catch a drop of falling rain. But would you drink that water after it hits the ground?
When water hits that pavement, as it travels, it picks up cigarette butts and sediment and oil and all sorts of things that are on that hard surface. And typically what happens is that water then is washed into a storm drain.
Ann Gelbman coordinates green infrastructure efforts at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The agency gives first preference to practices in stormwater permit applications that keep that dirty urban stormwater brew out of lakes and rivers. Here on University Avenue in St. Paul, the storm drains look pretty normal. But as Mark Donay of the Capital Region Watershed District explains, they're not.
Before, all the rain would just come right down to this catch basin and into a pipe and go straight to the river. What happens now along this stretch of University Avenue is these catch basins are actually going into a rock trench that feed the roots of the trees.
About 1,000 trees line several miles of University Avenue, helping reduce the area's stormwater runoff by over 50%. Danae says that's as high as they could get in an area that's fully developed with the existing buildings and a new light rail line. But a new development in Invergrove Heights that includes a Target store, other retail, and single-family homes was able to take it to the next level. Instead of traditional gutters and catch basins, the Argenta Hills site has cuts in the curb for stormwater to flow into rain gardens where plants soak it up. Part of the massive Target parking lot and some road intersections are porous, allowing water to seep into the ground. But drive along the development's main street and you're likely only to notice the nice landscaping and brick intersections.
Yeah, I don't think people even probably recognize that that's stormwater treatment.
Engineer Brett Emmons of Emmons and Olivier Resources helped design the system.
This is kind of almost hidden or woven into the site in a way that isn't so obvious, but it does its job. At the same time, it can be attractive.
You won't find another one like it in Minnesota. It's huge, more than 3,000 acres. When it rains, all the water stays on site. There are no underground pipes to carry it away to the Mississippi River. For smaller storms, that means it seeps into the ground through the rain gardens and pervious pavement. For bigger storms, low-lying basins collect the excess and prevent flooding. Emmons says in its first 5 years, the system is performing better than expected, showing green infrastructure's potential.
This site and this whole area of Invergrove Heights is proof that it can have a major, major impact.
Invergrove Heights Public Works Director Scott Thurene says the development might not have happened at all without the innovative stormwater system. The area is far from a stream or river where water could be discharged, and people balked at the estimate for a conventional system of pipes and pumps.
I know it got everyone's attention, and property owners who'd been obviously already talking developers were coming back saying that price is too high.
But green infrastructure isn't always cheaper. Permeable pavement, for example, can cost 2 to 3 times as much as traditional surfaces, though the cost has been coming down. So cities are trying to be strategic about where and when they adopt the practices. In most cases, it's when they're adding a new development or reconstructing an existing area. The MPCA's Ann Geldman says the data is still coming in on how much green infrastructure can improve a lake or river. But she says Minnesota's urban areas need to think about rainwater differently.
I would really like to see people think of rain as our resource and not just something that we have to get rid of.
That becomes even more important as Minnesota looks to cope with bigger storms brought on by climate change. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
There are only 3 wolves left on Isle Royale National Park, and that has reignited a debate over what to do about the dying wolves and the booming moose population on the island. The National Park Service is holding a series of open houses on the issue starting today. Tom Weber talked with Phyllis Green, the park superintendent at Isle Royale National Park.
What is this 2-year process that starts tonight? What will the end process be?
Basically, we really want to take a hard look at some of the different options that are out there for dealing with the low wolf numbers and potentially high moose numbers, and also try to do a few more in-depth studies on what's going on with vegetation and present that in the form of a management plan for moose and wolves and vegetation. And all of the consequences of that would be spelled out in an environmental impact statement so people could really understand the trade-offs, because there are trade-offs in everything we do.
One option is to reintroduce wolves. Another option is to cull populations or change the population of moose somehow. Another is to do nothing. Do you have, Phyllis Green, a set list of options right now?
Well, we have some that are we call preliminary concepts, if you will, and that's based on having heard from a lot of people over the past several years on some of the values that they have, some of the concerns they have. But it would be good to refine those and expand them where they're needed and make sure people understand what they can or cannot achieve relative to change on the island. So that's part of why we're going through the public scoping process. And if people can't visit us at one of the meetings, everything that is at the meetings will be posted online, and people can go to our planning website and provide official comment that way, too.
And we'll have a link there as well at mprnews.org. The options include variations of mimicking a migration by introducing wolves at some point. The options include doing absolutely nothing and just seeing where that goes and seeing what happens with the current population. Are you expecting, Phyllis, that the current population, specifically of wolves there, that three, is that going to go away? Are those three, is this going to be extirpation here on the island?
It's hard to say. It depends on whether they were able to breed successfully and what their numbers will be when we go out next year at winter study. You know, we had ice bridges out onto the island the last two winter seasons, and we actually, of course, had one wolf leave in that first year. And then in the second year, we actually had a female, we know that because she was collared, go out to the island with a young, a smaller wolf, so it could have either been a pup or perhaps a amorous male. But she basically, they did a walkabout. They went around about a third of the island and decided not to stay this past winter and left. And then the other change that was somewhat dramatic is, so two seasons ago we had 9 wolves on Isle Royale, and then this season we're down to 3. We knew that one had died on the island because we had a mortality signal, which accounts for the 3 plus 1 is 4. And then there are 5, though, that are unaccounted for. So we really actually don't know if those wolves walked off the island or if they perished, and for whatever reason we didn't pick up on that. But there's certainly the island still leaves a lot of question marks at different times. So
the fact, though, that you're taking this 2-year process to come up with this management plan means, doesn't that mean, though, that this might be too late for these wolves?
Well, the question is, from a genetic standpoint, these wolves were, you know, basically have impoverished genetics over the mainland wolves to begin with. So the question came up as to how effective would a genetic rescue be? It might actually boost the population, but it might not remove some of the issues that were within that current population.
You're talking about inbreeding, right?
Yes.
These meetings are starting this process. The first meeting's tonight in Houghton. Again, though, when you knew this was an issue for a while, are you getting at this too late by starting tonight this 2-year process?
Well, you could look at it from that perspective. If we had had wolves stay, if we'd have added wolves any time in the last 2 years and they had not settled in well to the island, they could have easily left. So I think what you really have to get at is what are your long-term objectives for when you start managing, because this is different than a natural environment where you let things just play out on their own, which
right.
is what has been happening. What are your objectives then that you're trying to achieve, and what will you do if the wolves choose a different course? Will you try to continue to do repopulation, or will you look to different avenues? So there's a lot to consider. It's not as cut and dried. It's very cut and dried for some people who want to look at it simply, but it is not cut and dried if you take into whole an island biogeography and how changes naturally occur on islands and how they'll throw a monkey wrench in every plan you think you can make. So some of our planning will be to look at options and backup options if once we decide on the objective we're trying to achieve.
And that was Phyllis Green, the park superintendent at Isle Royale National Park, talking with our Tom Weber earlier today. Time now for the latest Minnesota Sounds and Voices. Tom Cran has that intro.
The city of Winona has an immigration history that resembles much of Minnesota. Lots of Germans and Scandinavians, but with a twist. A surprising number of people from Poland. And like other immigrants who didn't speak English, most of the Polish people became laborers, even though many were highly educated.
As pharmacists, as teachers, as musicians, but they all had to work stacking logs.
In a new episode of Minnesota Sounds and Voices, Dan Olson takes us to the Polish Museum in Winona.
Polish pride runs deep in Father Paul Brisa, so he doesn't need much encouragement to shepherd Polish museum staff together for an impromptu performance of the homeland's national anthem. 77-year-old Paul Brisa is a retired Catholic priest. He was born and raised in Winona. The museum he started 30 years ago tells the story of Polish immigration to the city, with an important footnote. Many of the immigrants came from an area of northern Poland called Kashubia. And again, with very little encouragement, Brisa is happy to illustrate the Kashubian language, sort of, but not really related to Polish.
Jak tu idzie, Knopia? How are you, young boy?
As with so many other immigrants, the people arriving from Poland landed low-paying work as laborers, including jobs at Winona's sawmills.
2,000 people worked for the sawmills in Winona, 1,200 or more Polish.
There were lots of reasons Polish emigres left their home area. For decades, they were oppressed by a succession of neighboring powers. Poverty was widespread. For many of the men, the motive was to avoid unceasing war. Brisa's grandfather arrived in Winona to evade the military draft.
They were pretty much escapees from Kaiser Wilhelm.
The Polish Museum is near Winona's riverfront. It's in a rambling old building that was once the headquarters of a lumber company. Among the photos and artifacts is a bookcase filled with small pocket-sized volumes printed in Polish.
Prayer books. Nobody uses them anymore. They don't know how to read them, so they come here.
Brisa's tour includes identification and expert pronunciation of all sorts of items, including an otherwise mysterious baking implement.
This is a kapunka. You raise your bread in there.
By far the most eye-catching collection in the Polish Museum is the scissors art.
Wycinanki. I would go crazy cutting those out.
The cutters wielded sharp scissors to trim paper of various colors and then create spectacular designs of folk art that is fast disappearing. Some of the items in the museum collection are simply strange.
A cow horn squeezed around a piece of wood with a little flat lid on the top.
Turns out if you soak a cow's horn long enough, it can be shaped for all kinds of uses, including a snuff box. The museum has a small staff. Brisa is there most days to open the door. One of his first duties is to power up the background sound that greets visitors, Polish polka band music. Brisa says he created the museum to tell a story not often found in historical records.
You never save history of poor people, and Polish people were all deemed to be in that category. So something had to be done.
That's the NPR News Update for Monday. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for coming along for the journey. I'll have the Tuesday Minnesota News right back here tomorrow.